My name's Joanne Carlson Brown. I'm the wonderful and proud pastor of Tibbetts United Methodist Church in West Seattle. And I'm also an adjunct faculty member at Seattle U in the School of Theology and Ministry. And I am a church historian and trained as an historical theologian. And I have a special warm and lovely spot for heretics in through the church. And there were so many to choose from in fact, I was telling Sonia I thought of doing the last session as Luther as a heretic, but decided to stick with the early church. So we're going to be doing early church folks the whole week. This week is Gnostics, today is Gnostics, and tomorrow is the Montanists, and Wednesday is the Arians, and Thursday is the Pelagians, and Friday is the Donatists. So you can pick your heresy, which you'd like to do. And partly want to look at these to think about why they might have been condemned by the small C Catholic Church that didn't really totally exist, particularly with the Gnostic movement. And what they might, if anything, have to say to us today about how we might be looking at our own theology and our own understandings of things, and see where there are some understandings of it coming up. Because particularly for Gnosticism, quite frankly, the New Age movement is basically a Gnostic movement. All the wonderful New Agey crystals and all those fun, well, wonderful things get a lot of things from the Gnostics. Now, I really want you to interrupt me or throw things at me if I'm not paying any attention. Softer than a water bottle, I guess, would be great, so that we can have a conversation about this. If there are things that you're really interested in focusing on talking about, I want to spend some time with that, and I want to get your responses and your understandings about that. So with that, we can begin with the Gnostics. Everybody know what? Why they name Gnostics?
Secret knowledge.
Secret knowledge. And the Greek word for that is gnosis. G-N-O-S-I-S. So the Greek word for that is gnosis, and therefore they were called Gnostics. Some of them called themselves Gnostics. Most often it was the people writing against them who called them Gnostics. And that happens a lot with groups, is that the people that are against them call them a derogatory name, and then they say, oh, well, that's kind of a nice name, and they pick it up with it. The Gnostic folks, however, there is not like one kind of Gnostic movement. It's different than any of the other heretical movements that we're going to be looking at if you choose to come for the rest of the week. There wasn't just one little, there was a whole group of folks that get lumped together as Gnostics. Probably the best book, and it's a little old now, but still the best book on looking at the Gnostics and the Gnostic Gospels is Elaine Pagel's book called The Gnostic Gospels. There's some debate about whether there are pre-Christian Gnostics or not, or whether Gnosticism is basically a Christian heresy. I think you can find some elements of some sort of Gnosticism in pre-Christian, but I think really it is a Christian movement, or at least it understood itself to be a Christian movement, and so we'll be focusing on those folks. And what happened is the people looked around the world and they said, you know, it's a pretty yucky place. There are earthquakes and floods and famines and wars and people being really nasty to each other, and so, you know, the world is basically evil. And so one solution to we live in a basically evil, disgusting world is to say, well, you know, the world and its matter are just essentially evil. That's what it is. And that's what the Gnostics, they're very what we call dualistic in their thinking and understanding. So that material world and physical things are evil, and spiritual things, particularly the soul, are good. And so anything that's physical and mattery things is just not really quite wonderful. And so there are some disagreements. There are some Gnostic groups that were like into celibacy and asceticism and really trying to deny the body because of the evilness of the body. There was another couple of Gnostics that were kind of libertine, that said, well, if the body is evil and it really doesn't matter, because it's what's happened to your soul that matters, then you can do anything you want. And they did. and those are oftentimes the ones that particularly the early church writers pick out and write about, the really immoral, disgusting orgy guys. That are obviously having way more fun than anyone in the Orthodox Church was having. And so they were not really excited about that. But despite a number of their differences, there are some commonalities within this whole Gnostic movement that I thought would be good to talk about. And first of all, I'm sorry, please.
Is there a context for time?
Yes, I'm sorry, these are really, really early, first, second century.
Okay.
Particularly second century, and a lot of what we know now about the Gnostics, and there's some really new or some newish kind of things, and I have handouts. I don't have PowerPoint or anything. I'm an historian. I'm lucky. I'm still not writing with a quill and ink, but I have handouts for everybody when we get there. But one of the ways that we know a lot about Gnosticism was discovered. In the 1945, the Nag Hammadi Library was a whole bunch of, come across in a cave by some shepherd boy, and there were a bunch of jars that had papyruses, and they didn't know what it was, but they thought, well, it might be okay, it's kind of like the Dead Sea Scrolls that they found too. We got the Dead Sea Scrolls, but these are the Gnostic Gospels, and obviously some Gnostic group that was being persecuted hid them away. And so now we have a whole collection of what Gnostics actually said, and their own Gospels, which is different than what the Orthodox Church says that they said. And sometimes you can get, and for a lot of these folks, you have to use what the arguments that were made against them, because oftentimes they quoted what the person said in order to refute it. And so if you pull out the quotes without the commentary, you can begin to piece together a little bit more about what they had to say. But we have a few things that some of these folks wrote. We have way more now about the Gnostics, but only recently. The Gnostic Gospels were written in Coptic. They're a Coptic translation of the Greek. And so this is an English translation of the Coptic translation of the Greek. and so it's, you know, you get there. And then there are huge, and you'll see in the section I'm going to give you, huge sections that are missing because of the poor condition of the papyrus that they found. And so big chunks or even pages are missing. And so we can begin to piece together some of those. So, but one of the common elements and understandings of Gnostics is that they explained the existence of the world not as the result of the will of a good God, you know, like we have our wonderful creation story in Genesis, but as the result of an error or of malice on the part of some celestial being. Almost all of the Gnostics have this understanding of the pleroma, the oneness, and that oneness gets defined as numerous things, but most often termed wisdom. Again, Gnostics, secret knowledge is, so Sophia means wisdom, and so wisdom, and there's this sense that all the things that were usually that are usually called moral, material reality are evil, and the other things, usually spiritual reality, are all good, and that includes human souls. And poking fun at such teachings because they said, you know, their material earth was created by these little demigods or little eon gods. Tertullian, who was writing in the second century, commented, "My God made heaven and earth, and you cannot point to a measly vegetable that yours has produced after all these centuries." So I thought Tertullian has a great sense of humor. He's really quite funny to read. I mean, a lot of the early church guys are not. Tertullian is a scream. And he talked about martyrdom, and he said, if the Tiber rises, if the Nile doesn't, if there is flood or if there is famine, the cry goes up, "The Christians to the lion." He said, "What, all of them to one lion?" And so he's really pretty good. So they have there's one principle, the pleroma, the fullness. And within that, there's a series of distinct beings that are purely spiritual, which most Gnostic called eons. And in each Gnostic system, there were different number of eons. For example, Vasilides, there were 365 eons, each corresponding to the different day of the year. In some other systems, the eons were given names that were in Greek were masculine, like word or abyss, etc., and others were given female names, truth, wisdom, etc. And then it was claimed that pairs of these eons beget lesser eons until at the end of this process, you get one of the eons that begat the world or created the world. One of my favorite Gnostic stories about creation is that Sophia has produced this little demiurge guy, and he's kind of perturbed that nobody's paying any attention to him. Nobody's worshiping him. Nobody loves him. Nobody does anything. So he's going to go off and he's going to create a little world where everybody will know him and love him. So he goes and he creates this world. And he creates two little human beings to be in the world. And then tells them that he is a jealous God and that there are no other gods before him. Now, if there are no other gods already, why do you have to tell them? So, because there are all these other little eons and things, this Yahweh God has to tell them that he's the only one, and there really isn't anyone else, and you shouldn't worship anybody else, and you're just me, and I'm your creator, and I'm the one that you should focus on. Wisdom, his mom, sees what he's doing, and she can't really stop him, but what she does is she puts a little spark in each of the little human beings. And it's a spark that will help them remember where they really belong, which is not in this evil material world, but in the pleroma, in the fullness. And that their goal is to return to it. And it's Sophia that plants the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And then, so that's why the little demiurge Yahweh has to say, "Don't eat of that tree. You can have every other tree, but don't eat of that tree. Because if you eat of that tree, then you'll know that this is, he doesn't say it, but he knows that if they eat of that tree, they're going to know this isn't their real home. And that their whole existence will be then to try and get back to their real home, and they won't worship him anymore. And so Sophia plants that tree of knowledge. And then for that group of Gnostics, the snake is not Satan. The snake is Jesus, who's coming to give them the knowledge they need for salvation with it. Because that's what made the Gnostics popular. I mean, it's really an elitist, esoteric kind of understanding, and I don't get why a lot of people would be Gnostics. Actually, they didn't want a lot of people to be Gnostics. This was not a universal religion by any means. It was not a, "Y'all, come! We just love you." No, it's you have to have this secret knowledge. But the reason that the attraction for people of Gnosticism offered was not necessarily this explanation of this sort of evil world or anything, but it was the promise of a means of salvation. And the means of salvation for Gnostics is to escape from this world. And escape from the prison that your body is. Your body is a, for the Gnostics, your body is a prison. And it's, and it has captured and imprisoned your soul, which is that spark that Sophia put in, and that the whole goal is to release the soul so that it can go through its little journeys of through the eons, up to finally to the pleroma, where you want to get. It's kind of like the Buddhist nirvana when you finally get there.
So for that reason, Joanne, did they see physical death as a good thing?
Oh, it was an excellent thing.
Something to be strived for rather yeah. than feared?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's
because it finally removes you from your, it frees you from this prison. And in fact, a lot, that's, and I would argue that most, even though the early church folks focus on the libertine kind of Gnostics who are running around doing anything that they wanted to do, most of the Gnostics are celibate, and one of the reasons they're celibate is because it's not fair to trap another soul into a body. I mean, that's it's a horrible thing to do. And so that if you reproduce, all you're doing is capturing and imprisoning another soul.
I guess one can argue that an attraction might be then if it's a practice and a praxis that frees you from the fear of death. Then that could be a very healthy thing. And, you know,
yeah.
Paul talked about that too. So there must have been sort of what we would describe as healthy Gnostics that were practicing a spirituality that freed them from living a life of fear of death. So
I
agree with their unmaterialism, but one
yeah.
could argue that that element alone could be a healthy, freeing
yeah.
thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and that's part of the reason I want to look at these folks is that it's not everything that they have is not really weird and bad. I mean, a lot of it is a little weird, and I can see why some of the folks, some of these writings in the Nag Hammadi Library, you can understand why they didn't make it in. you into the canon. You read these, and I'm like, oh, seriously. There's the Acts of Thomas, not the Gospel of Thomas. The Gospel of Thomas is one of the few early Gnostic texts that were recovered a long time ago, and so people were working really with the Gospel of Thomas. But the Acts of Thomas is a different one, and we don't know much about Jesus when he was a little kid. The Acts of Thomas fills that in. So it's Jesus as a little kid, and he's God and he knows it. He's five, and he's God, and he knows it. Now, all of you that are parents, that have a five-year-old that thinks and knows he's God, and can act on it. And so he turns his playmates into pigeons, turns his teachers into pigs. He's a brat. So I can understand why the Acts of Thomas did not get in. Although it's kind of nice to fill in Jesus' childhood, but, you know, something more than he showed up at the temple when he was 12 and then all of a sudden he appears when he's 30. And then there's the Protevangelium of James that has Jesus springing full-grown from the head of Mary, which is, for anybody who knows their Greek mythology, is a direct rip-off of the birth of Athena, who springs full-grown out of the head of Zeus. Because sexuality was just not their thing. You know, they just, you, being born, no. Jesus just appeared somehow. So you read some of these and you get why they're not. I'm like really grateful that they're not. We have enough trouble with Revelation. We don't need some of these other ones that are there. So this salvation was that second common point that they have. The first one is that pleroma and the thing. And the second one is this salvation. And it's attained by secret knowledge. And it's based on the view of the world and the secret knowledge provided you with the secret key to ascend through the spheres. Because you had to get through the spheres in order to make it up to the pleroma, to the fullness. And it's based on the cosmology of the time. So the Earth is at the center of the universe, and then there are usually seven corresponding spheres around, corresponding to the sun, the moon, and the five most visible planets. So you had to make your way through each one of these spheres in order finally to get to fullness or pleroma with that. And in order to get through each one of these little spheres, you had to have the secret password. And only Gnostics knew the secret password to make it through all these wonderful eons. And so when you, because these spheres are acting like prison, layers of imprisonment of the soul, which precludes its ascent to the pleroma. So everything is a barrier, and you need your secret knowledge, you need your secret word, your like secret handshake. In order to get it. I saw a cartoon once where there was a guy that came and said what the secret word is. Says, no, that was last week's. So you had to be current with your Gnostics. You couldn't just fall behind with it. And so,
John,
sure.
But that cosmology is the same that Dante has, right? And he's ascending, or first descending, then ascending up through
yeah.
the spheres with the guide of wisdom, and Virgil, and the other poet.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's not.
No, yeah, and it is. It's that level, it's at seven levels, or nine levels of hell that Dante has. And this is, and it depends. It's usually seven, but you can have more. Basilides had some more that you had to get through. But mostly it was, for most of the Gnostics, it was seven, because it was the sun, the moon, and the five most visible planets that they could see, and you had to have these secret knowledge and get the password. And so it continues its ascent using its secret passwords till it finally gets to the pleroma, where it has joy and wonder, and it gets to stay there, unless it somehow falls down and gets imprisoned in another body again, and then it has to begin its ascent all over again, which is not a wonderful thing. So Jesus, for the Gnostics, is the messenger from above, or from the pleroma, who brought to earth the message of salvation to remind souls of their divine nature, and to provide the secret knowledge necessary for one's return to the pleroma, which is why I think that it really is a Christian heresy. Because Jesus is the one who brings the knowledge, the secret knowledge of all his teachings. And you can even see bits of that in the Gospels that are already accepted that we have, where that Jesus says, you know, let those who have ears hear. So that not, and the Gnostics use that all the time. Not everybody who hears will understand or get it. And there's this secret knowledge. And so sometimes I have people read bits of the Gospel of Mark, and then I put it against another Gnostic text and ask them which one of the Gnostic texts is. And a number of ones pick out Mark because of that, and the messianic secret in Mark, where Jesus says that he's the Messiah, where people guess that he's the Messiah, and he says, don't tell anyone about it. With that, and so it's so you get that layer with it, and so that's why in that one creation myth from one of the Gnostics that Jesus is the snake who's bringing the knowledge, and Jesus entrusts this secret of salvation, this saving gnosis, to a favorite one of his disciples, and so the different Gnostic groups focus on one of the disciples that has been given the secret knowledge, not to the rest of them, and they pick it up again from reading the Gospels, where you know the disciples are basically dim, and particularly in Mark, they never get it, they never understand. It's like, can't you repeat that? could you like make it a little more clear? And the fact that Jesus teaches in parables and teaches in these ways that you have to figure out what it means. And you can do that if you have the secret knowledge. But if you're one of the plain people the ignorant people, then you don't get it, and you don't have it. And so Jesus usually, for these folks, entrusted to one of his disciples, the favored one, the truly spiritual one, who received the liberating and the secret gnosis. And then this teaching was bequeathed to the Gnostic teacher by the disciple. And so they have their own little apostolic succession, where they trace their understanding back to that particular disciple. It's actually against this idea of only one disciple and finding that the whole understanding of apostolic succession that the early church figures out. But still, they have a little touch of that gnosis because you know who it goes through. It goes through Peter. So it's still going through one special favored disciple who gets it. A couple years ago, there was a big splash with the Gospel of Judas. They recently found the Gospel of Judas. Well, that's a Gnostic text, and it's a prime example. Judas in the Gospel of Judas is the only one who really understands Jesus' message. That the soul is entrapped in the body and has to be free for its ascent into the fullness. And this is the reason that he betrays, quote-unquote, betrays Jesus, although his action is not really a betrayal, but it's an act of obedience to his master who had to be freed from his physical body. With that. And so Judas does exactly what Jesus needs him to do and tells him to do. And so he's not the betrayer, he's the special favored disciple who knows the gnosis. And if you read the Gospel of Judas, then you see some of the teachings of how to get through the Pleroma and all these other things. Now, the one that I did bring, they're not stapled together. I ran out of time. And there are 25 of them, so there must be. So just grab one and pass it around. Is to look at the Gospel of Mary. There are a number of Gnostic Gospels. There's the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Truth, and the one I want to look at just a little bit is the Gospel of Mary. And it's because for the Gnostics, actually, Mary was a very special kind of person, and understood Mary as the person that Jesus loved the most. And it's partly out of response to the fact that the Gnostics put so much emphasis on Mary that Tertullian, can we pass them up to the heretics in the balcony?
Yeah.
it's partly in response to the to this attention and special devotion to Mary, Mary Magdalene, that Tertullian starts the understanding that Mary Magdalene was a prostitute. You cannot find it in the Gospels. It does not say that she's a prostitute. It says she had seven demons, but that was it. But the whole understanding that she's the prostitute or the woman caught in adultery or things is Tertullian and the rest of the early church picking that up to, again, discredit the Gnostics. Of the person they're looking at. So the Gospel of Mary, and there's a little introduction there. And I'm sorry, I had to photocopy it from my own books, which means that you get all my scribblings. I think they've got them. What do you mean?
Yeah.
Everybody got one?
You one.
And see, they're ascending to the first level. Of
no,
you guys are closer. Not quite the play Roma. They're in the first level, maybe up to the sun.
We'll be there by the end.
Yeah, there you go. So there's a little introduction to it, and it's again unknown composition, Coptic, early 5th century, and it's a Greek fragment dated to the early 3rd century, and it's in different parts and. I think you can probably read my little scribblings around it that might help you see it. The first, it can be divided into two parts by content. Mary plays a really very minor role in the first section. whereas she's the dominant character in the second section. The first section, of which the first six pages are missing, so you know we miss a lot of what was there. It's in conversational form with the disciples posing questions and the Savior replying. And this is a familiar theme in Gnostic literature of this type, where Jesus says something that the disciples question. The fact that all the way through this, Jesus is referred to not as anything else but the Savior, is also a giveaway that it's a Gnostic text. Because that's Jesus' primary, that is Jesus' only role, is as Savior with to impart the secret knowledge. So this is a discussion on the mat on matter and a discourse on sin, which says that matter is sin and evil and all this sort of disgusting stuff. The Savior then issues a charge to the disciples to preach the gospel and then departs. His disciples are distraught and overwhelmed at their task. And then Mary makes her first appearance in a comforting and strengthening them. So that you get the whole bit in the first page where matter and evil and Peter says, since you've explained everything to us on this first page that you have, tell us what is the sin, and then the Savior talks about that. And keeps going on about it. And then you can see there's a lot of references to scriptures with that, some of which I've scribbled in on my side notes there. And then when the Blessed One had said this, he greets them all, peace be with you, receive peace to yourself. Anybody who's listened to John recognizes that as part of the farewell discourse with that. And beware that nobody leads you astray, and then I appointed you. Do not give, and don't do any rules beyond what I've laid down for you, and don't be constrained. And when he said this, they departed. But then they were grieved and they wept greatly. And how should we go to the Gentiles and preach the gospel? If they didn't spare him, how are they going to spare him? And then this is the transition to the second part, where Mary appears. So she stands up, greets them all, and you know, tries to comfort them and says, you know, really, it'll be fine. We really need to just go on what to do there. And then Peter asks her to share with the group the words which the Savior told her alone. So for the Gospel of Mary, Mary is the favored disciple. The one who got the secret knowledge that has to be shared with everyone else. And so then Mary relates the appearance of the Savior in a vision. Again, four pages are missing in this section, but it appears that she describes the journey of the soul, that the soul must overcome hostile powers to attain the rest of the eon in silence. And then Mary's vision meets with opposition from Andrew and Peter. They question why the Savior would reveal these things to a woman and not to his disciples. And then at the end, Levi comes to Mary's defense, saying that the Savior knew her well, made her worthy, and loved her more. And then he repeats the Savior's charge, and with that they leave, going forth to preach. So that's pretty much what's here in there. Again, it looks like it's two separate pieces that's joined together. There's no attempt to, because it's in Coptic, there's no attempt to harmonize the language with the Gospels, so you can see echoes of the Gospels, but they're not exact repeats of it. They're not exact quotes from what we would have from the Greek part with that. So there's the Be of Good Courage, which reflects Acts 23:11, 27:25, and John, the judging passage, and numerous. So, this is very clearly a Christian Gnostic composition, into which earlier material has been added, probably some Greek aspects and understandings with that. And and what's important is that clearly Mary is in the room when Jesus is imparting the secret knowledge in the first part, because she's the one that stands up and says, oh, now everybody settle down, things will be fine, it'll be great, we'll do that. And she is the principal person in that second one, but we find attitudes about women that are made explicit two different positions that sometimes you can find in the Gnostics. Peter asks her to proclaim the teachings which she alone knows, which points to an understanding that it was not unheard of for Jesus to especially teach women. Again, for the Gnostics, it doesn't matter whether you're a woman or a man in the Gnostics, because they don't really care about the body. It's the soul that's important. And so they don't make some of those distinctions. Except in a few of the Gnostic texts, you can see some disagreement with that. Like here, where Peter, after Mary shares her vision, has a change of heart. After he's the one that asks her to share her vision. She shares her vision, and then Peter has a change of heart. Provoked by Andrew's voiced doubt. And partly some people think that's jealousy, that Peter and Andrew, who thought they were like the ones that Jesus liked most, gave it to a woman and to this married person and not to me. And that's not really really good. And it's specifically for Peter because she's a woman. Not just because it's some other disciple, but because it's a woman. And you can see this in some other Gnostic Gospels, notably the Pistis Sophia, and in the last Logion of the Gospel of Thomas. The Gospel of Thomas is just a series of sayings from Jesus. I refer to it as quotations from Chairman Jesus. with that, there's no narrative around it. There's nothing. It's just a section, just saying after saying after saying after saying. The very last one, Logion 1:14, and I actually will argue is added because it doesn't match the rest of it. It's the risen Christ is walking along with the disciples, and Peter asks Jesus, what's going to happen to Mary come the resurrection? Because for his understanding, women don't get that privilege. And Jesus says, oh, not to worry. Come the resurrection, I'm going to turn her into a man. And up she will go with that. And it's different because you read some of the other Logians in the Gospel of Thomas, and they'd say I'm the male and the female, and they don't make the distinction. So I think that that last Logian was added, and not necessarily by a Gnostic. with that, and it's because a lot of the early church Orthodox, quote unquote Orthodox folks, had that attitude toward women and an understanding that women just were not kind of quite make salvation with it. Augustine has in the 4th century has a different a different view. He says no, you know, women and men were created at creation and therefore will be part of the redemption. It's just that come the resurrection, those parts in women that were created for shame will be transformed into glory. It's what I refer to as the great hysterectomy in the sky. And some of us are a little closer to salvation than others at this point in our lives. With that, and it's just... So, you know, they all had their ways of getting women, and some had their ways of getting women into heaven come the resurrection. Some of them were just going to be moldering in the grave.
That's the one everybody quotes, right? Yeah. I'm curious, so the point of the Gnostic Gospels that was not like I'm assuming they had access to the other Gospels. Mm-hmm. They weren't retelling the life and teachings of Jesus. It was saying, this is the secret knowledge.
This is the secret knowledge. And this is what's not in all these other gospels are imparting the secret knowledge that is not in the four gospels that got put into the canon. I mean, partly the canons and the creeds get developed in the early church precisely because of these movements.
Mm-hmm.
It's to define them out. And so you have all of these Gnostic Gospels that, you know, say, you know, sure, you can have your Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. There's also Philip and Truth and Mary and all those other wonderful things. And they're going, oh, no, really not going to happen with it. And the canon is really fluid for the first 3-4 centuries. Some, you know, I probably should have brought a little chart on what gets in the canon, what gets out at various times. The Shepherd of Hermas is in, and then it's out. And actually, I think it should have been in. It's a nice, wonderful ethical text on how to live. And then Revelation is in, it's out, it's in, it's out. Unfortunately, the last one, it got in. and I'm like, seriously, you know, John, too many mushrooms, you know? There's some really nice things in Revelation, but, you know, blood up to the bridle of the horses is, you know, no.
Joanne, question.
Yeah.
In the Bible study earlier this morning, she used the metaphor of a watershed and talked about sources that flow into. What were some of the sources that existed, pre-Christian sources, that would support the idea of a Gnosticism arising around Christian teachings? Or is it your sense that, I mean, these are very elaborate constructions and philosophies. So what are some of the precursors that were maybe the headwaters or streams that existed that ended up kind of latching on to Christianity and a Christology, you know, the Gnostic Christology?
Yeah, and I think a lot of it, particularly this immortality of the soul and the reality of matter being yucky and not and evil, is Platonic. It's Plato. With Plato, because this is not reality for Plato. This is an illusion. Reality are the ideals that exist up with the gods up in heaven. So that we know that this is a chair, because there is chairness, and chairness is the reality. This is not.
This is an
imperfect. This is an illusion. It's like the allegory of the cave, if you read Plato's Republic, where they're down in the cave and they only see the reflections on the wall of the trees and everything, and they think that's real because that's all they've ever seen, until they're led out of the cave into the bright sunlight and they can't see for a while, and then they see what's real. Well, for Plato, that's what happens to us. We're in this world of shadows and unreality, and we think that what we have is real, but it's not. The real thing is the ideal thing. And so there's some of that Platonic understanding coming in. There's a little Zoroastrianism in the eons and the cosmology and the and the things. And then I think they just had an incredibly fertile mind about, because they start out with, well, matter is evil. And the world is evil, and there has to be something good, and so the soul is good. And how did that soul get in? Well, we get this little spark get put in, and we have to escape from it, and we've got all these levels together. Paul, there are places in Paul where Paul talks about the seven levels of heaven. They're using Paul's letters, they're using some of the Gospels that they have, and their own understanding of that. I think they're getting some of that Platonic philosophy that, quite frankly, so does Paul with that, and some Zoroastrianism from the Eastern aspects of that, and then putting it all together in this Christian, or at least their understanding of a Christian mythos to make sense of the world. All any of these folks are trying to do is to make, one, make sense of the world. How did we get here? Why are we here? What is the purpose? And how are we saved? It's the question Luther starts with. How do I know that I'm saved? Well, they want to know how they're saved. Well, their understanding of how they're saved is that they finally escape this evil body that's imprisoning them and have to make this journey of the eons that's separating them from their pleroma. And also I said that pleroma is also kind of like nirvana in Buddhism. So there might be some of that Eastern stuff. Because it's growing up in the crossroads of the ancient world. I mean, there were all kinds of folks coming from the East and the West that there were all kinds of different ideas that people get, and we'll see that in some of the other guys.
This is sort of building on that, but also simmering for the last half hour. You mentioned how you made reference to the New Age movement of the last 30 years or whatever, and how there are elements of Gnosticism in that. And yet, as you've been talking about this, many of the elements I grew up with, you know, the body is bad, the real life is in heaven, you know, many, you know, Gnostic dimensions have very happily made a home in the kind of Christianity, despite our denomination, that many of us were raised in. And I'm just curious, as you look at this, and as you look down at the Montanists and the Palladians, I guess I'm asking for a preview. Are you going to be arguing that many of those very elements exist always, like microbes in our bodies, in the culture, but also in the church?
Oh, absolutely, in the
itself.
Church.
So there's Gnosticism outside in the New Age movement, but there's plenty of Gnosticism.
Yeah, there's the
heresy.
Yeah, there's
within
the,
Christianity.
Yeah, there's the weirdness. I think of some of the Gnostics, the sort of the seven habits, different habits of it. But certainly, Paul picked up the dualism. Plato's very dualistic, and so picks up that Greek dualism that does not exist in Jewish understanding. The body, nature, everything is good in Judaism. You know, the creation story, the first one creates, and God says, and it's good. And everything, you know, so that the creation is good. And that's a Jewish understanding. It's the Greek stuff that comes in. That makes that dualism stuff, that then a lot of the Greek philosophy stuff like that, particularly Plato, was very influential on Augustine. Enforces that bodies are bad, matter is bad, and the dualism, and starts, then they put it together with bodies are bad, soul or mind is good, women are bodies. Men are minds, and with that, and it gets all developed all the way through. So some of that dualism that the Gnostics pick up and really go with is absolutely part of Christianity.
You mentioned Mark, of course, as having those Gnostic elements.
Yeah.
John has long been seen, right?
Yes.
As a semi-Gnostic gospel.
Yeah.
For a lot of the, I mean, the Logos is right.
Yeah,
there,
yeah.
Know,
in the beginning was the Logos, and
I don't know. Is there any indication that any of the Gnostic groups really favored John as of the canonical Gospels, or are they really just focused primarily on their own text?
Well, they're focused on their own text, but as I if you look on my, I don't know if you can read my little notes on your, but I've noted a number of the places where there's John 16, but Acts, John 14, Matthew 24, and then on page 472 at the bottom, you did not see me nor recognize me, and part of that is coming, we question from the fourth gospel, which is the reply of the soul to one of the cosmic powers. So yeah, I mean, they did like John a lot, but they quoted from different ones, but they're selected. And they're pulled out, so again, it's part of the reason why I argued that I think Gnosticism, there isn't much pre-Christian Gnosticism. I think it really is a Christian development that uses the text they already have, and then creates their own, and then picks out and chooses what's good in there for them that fits with what they want.
But is that all that different from the construction, say, of Gospel of Matthew, right?
Nope.
Picking all these texts to assemble.
Nope.
Right. Yeah.
It's exactly
the
what
same
they did.
Sort of.
And they just didn't get in. I mean, some of them actually make pretty good sense, and I think they would have been really nice to be included. And Derek, and who knows why some.
Are there apocryphal Gnostic texts in the Apocrypha?
No.
Okay.
I wouldn't say so. Not. It's more that intertestamental and has much more Jewish flavor.
Okay.
Anytime you read some of the Jewish, and it's part of the reason why some of the Gnostics rejected the entire First Testament, because it describes that God Yahweh, who is this jealous God who created and screwed us up in the first place by creating this world that entrapped souls, and so Marcion oftentimes is referred to as a Gnostic. He's not a really true Gnostic, but in that sense of rejecting the entire First Testament and then picking and choosing and making his own little God, his own little canon. Mostly Luke, however, is and you don't see a lot of Luke in, as Luke is very embodied in the Gospel. You see very little Luke in Gnostic writings. You'll see much more Matthew, Mark, or John in that. And so I would argue Marcion is not a Gnostic, even though he gets lumped in with them, with that.
I don't know enough about biblical history, but when the canon was chosen, how much is recorded about what the arguments were and what was chosen and not chosen?
It depends on what council you're reading. there are some records of the councils, not verbatims of the debates, but just around 250, this is the one that was, this is the group of stuff that's accepted, and around 300, and then finally the canon is closed at 4, can't remember exactly the date, but around 400 something, the canon is closed, and that's it. There's no other, and again, one of the things when we talk about, if you come back tomorrow, we talk about Montanus, they have a whole third testament to add. The Gnostics have all these other wonderful gospels and other writings, and there's one that's called the Thunder Perfect Mind that is truly bizarre. I could read you a little bit of the Thunder Perfect Mind. It's just really strange. But it's really, if you're interested, the Nag Hammadi, picking up the Nag Hammadi and looking at it is really interesting in reading what they have to say. And I always also recommend Elaine Pagel's book on the Gnostic Gospels.
I wonder how much the Gnostics were truly mystics in the deepest sense of it. Because you can read Julian of Norwich, and that's some of that can get pretty out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of mysticism as an important and essential strand of our tradition and kind of underknown and under-practiced, and it can be expressed verbally in all sorts of ways that might seem a little out there.
Yeah.
And so the Gnostics in some way might have had that dimension of, really deep spiritual practice, which doesn't get real close to words, and does have a not non-body experience, but if you think even in terms of modern physics, that we have several, now even visible by certain technology, certain energetic bodies as well as physical bodies, so it's not antibody, but it just includes
right. Kind
of that wider being which is not completely physical,
right. Which
I think those who practice deep meditation and mysticism, they experience that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just wonder if there's that
right, and you,
dimension.
And you have some of those mystics,
yeah,
that experience the going through the levels of even St. Teresa's interior castle.
Yeah.
On how you get up to heaven, you go through all these, you go up through the levels and things. And I think that there's a lot, mystics are always on the very thin edge of orthodoxy and heresy.
Right.
Always have
been. And
they're
not popular with the church.
No, no, because they don't need the intercession of priests. They just have direct access. And nobody should, that's, after the canon is closed, that's it. There's nothing, revelation is done, and there is no direct access to God anymore. And the mystics are always right on the cutting edge. Some of them make it, some of them don't get burned, and a lot of them do with that. Gnostics were persecuted, but they were persecuted along with other Christians. because there wasn't a group of Christians. They were just written against. A lot of, there were Irenaeus, Tertullian, a lot of folks write against the Gnostics, seeing it as a very dangerous kind of work. And part of it, again, there's some, because for a lot of the Gnostics, Jesus does not have a physical body. So the incarnation, not so much with it. It's he simply appeared to have a human body, which is the docetist understanding, which just means to appear. So Jesus appeared to have a physical body, and he came in, because that's the way he could communicate to us the secret knowledge and the special knowledge to free us from the bondage of the material bodies. Or he took on a special kind of body that was not made of earthly substance, but of a special substance. So it wasn't like ours, really. And in the places where Jesus seemed to be human with a physical human body, it's a mere appearance, he didn't eat for the Gnostics. Or if he did eat, it was not because he needed sustenance, but rather to keep the fiction that he was truly human. With that, and then in fact, some of the Docetists claim that Jesus was not born, but simply appeared, so to speak, out of thin air, or the one from the Proto-Evangelium, James, where he springs full grown from Mary's head, and one of the other ones that really separates them from Christianity, that really did it in, was that the Gnostics then claimed that Jesus had not really suffered and died on the cross, because he was not a human body. He wasn't, and a lot of them. One of them, it's a thing called the Laughing Savior, where Simon of Cyrene comes and picks up the cross, and at some point there's a little switcheroo, and it's Simon of Cyrene who's crucified on the cross, and the Savior is sitting on top of the cross laughing. Because they think that they've done him in, but they couldn't because he didn't have a real body to be. So you can see that that isn't going to make it in. that's not going to make it into the Christian understanding, because that sort of does in traditional understanding of salvation. So salvation for the Gnostics, the cross, has nothing to because Jesus didn't have a human body and didn't really die on the cross. And so the cross, you guys can focus on that if you want, but that's necrophilic and materialistic. And you know, we're doing the biophilic, kind of wonderful, earthly, spiritual kind of things. And so I talked a little bit about the celibacy and the libertine. If the body doesn't matter, if it's material, it's evil. But what happened then is that with the ethics, is that they were not overly concerned with the suffering of anybody else's body. So they didn't really do anything to alleviate anybody's pain, suffering. They weren't doing charity, they weren't doing anything. They really are a very intellectual, esoteric, elitist group of folks with that. That the mind is what you value. And then they tended to withdraw from the worship of the church, which also does not endear them to the Orthodox group of folks. Because the other worshipers, being unenlightened, were not true worshipers. So why would you worship with the great unwashed that don't really understand what's going on? And because Christian worship centered on the Eucharist. For the Gnostics, it was like, seriously, eating a piece of bread, drinking some...
And that's body?
Yeah, it's material. It's by, you know, it's like how could eating bread and drinking wine have anything to do with a purely spiritual truth? And the same thing with baptism. How can physical water that drops from the clouds and flows in the rivers, be connected to true rebirth of a truly spiritual being? So they don't participate in the sacraments because that's all spiritual and material and stuff, and it has absolutely nothing to do with us, with it. So you get some of the reasons why Gnostics, the people are going to write against the Gnostics, because it goes against some of the absolute core understandings: the incarnation, the suffering, death on the cross, any of the sacraments, and so their own worship. And then this, you know, you just have to have the secret knowledge, and a few of us have it, and the rest of you, too bad. Have a wonderful time moldering around in the material world. You're just not going to get there at all with the vision. So those are Gnostics, and really quick little, I usually do this like course in like over 10 weeks. So I'm just giving you a flavor and hoping that you will be maybe more interested in reading about some more folks. I am also around all week. If folks want to chat me up, I try and hang out under the green umbrella up on the arc, but I'm around as well. But so that's Gnostics in an hour. And please keep the handouts if you'd like to. You're welcome to hold on to them. I will have handouts every day of writings that we've been able to recover from folks. I thank you for your patience and your presence in being here, and I hope that we will see you again. And please, let's carry on the conversation, not with just me, but among yourselves, because it had some really excellent ideas about how we can see some of these elements coming in into Christianity and affecting what it is, even though they would be, and what happens with heresy all the time is that it's squelched, and then it pops up again, and then it's squelched and it's popped up again. I was referring to it once as a whack-a-mole. You know, you hit it and it pops up somewhere else, and all through history you can see it popping up all over the place with these different these different kinds of understanding, particularly of having secret knowledge. Any of the secret like Masonic organizations and stuff that have secret rites, it comes some of that from that. So thank you again for your patience and attention.